There is a story that is told from the London raid of World War II. And I don't know how true this story is, but I think it's told to make a certain point. And that is this, that during the bombing of London, this flat was completely crushed by bombs that were falling from the sky. And this father ran out into the street with his children to get out of his collapsing building. And there in the street was a large and deep crater that had been left by one of the bombs that had been dropped. And for safety's sake, as things are exploding around them, the father jumped down into the hole and he looks back up and he calls to one of his little children and says, "Jump." And the little boy says, "But I can't see you." And the father said, "It's okay. I can see you." Well, the two intertwined stories that we come to this morning, I think, are kind of illustrated by that. That there are two people who are as dissimilar as you could probably imagine two people being. One of them being probably a wealthy Jewish ruler of a synagogue. The other being a woman. A woman who lived as an outcast on the fringe of society. And in this moment of time, all of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, say suddenly their lives became intertangled. Their stories became intertangled with each other. And they both come to Jesus, in a sense, with this fledgling, broken faith, where, in a sense, Jesus is calling them into something that looks to them to be impossible and desperate. And Jesus is, in a sense, saying, "Jump." And they're saying, "But I can't see." And he's saying, "But I can see you." Let's read together Luke chapter 8, verses 40 through 56 this morning. "Now, when Jesus returned," this is from across the Sea of Galilee, "the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue. And falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge or a hemorrhage of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, 'Who was it that touched me?' When all denied it, Peter said, 'Master, the crowds surround you and are pressing in on you.' But Jesus said, 'Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me.' And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace.' While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, 'Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore.' But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, 'Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well.' And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, 'Do not weep, for she is not dead, but is sleeping.' And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, 'Child, arise.' And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given to her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened." This is God's word. Now, I think a theme that holds these two stories together, again, is as different as these two people are that are coming to Jesus, is that both of them are living with some source of despair, some source of desperation, or we could say hopelessness. And so I think this is a message about how Jesus breathes hope into our life. You know, it would be easy to say, "Well, I'm nothing like this woman and I haven't had a child die on me recently that I'm asking Jesus for this miraculous out of time resurrection." And it may be hard to identify with them. I want to make this more general because we all suffer. We all have things in our lives, either past or present or certainly future if the Lord doesn't return, that cause us to some degree or another to lose hope. And I call these things thieves of hope. things that come into our lives that even if we have a baseline of hope before God or with God, these things come in and very quickly take over our minds, take over our hearts, our emotions, our reactions, and they steal that hope and they leave us desperate and frustrated and hopeless. And I see five of these things straight out of this text. Number one, I see the duration of suffering is a thief of hope. And all these writers here say that this one particular woman who comes to Jesus, she had been in her condition for 12 years. Now, I want you to pause and think about that. I have a 12-year-old daughter sitting here. And so when you are able to conceptualize of time, it's not just like she struggled this for a while. They're not generic. This is one of those specific stories in Luke where he says it's been 12 years. It's been 12 Christmases, as it were, 12 Easters. As, I mean, Easter hasn't happened yet. That's anachronistic, but you know what I mean. Like 12 cycles of summer and spring and fall and winter that she's going around and around. And each year, maybe it gets warmer and she's hoping that the new birth in the spring that she sees will bring a new birth in her body where she stops this hemorrhage of blood. And it doesn't come. And again, from a more general standpoint, most of you probably know that when you first initially start experiencing that suffering, it calls other people's attention to what you're going through. And they're like, I'm there for you. I'm praying for you. I'll do all these things for you to show that I'm one of the ones that'll walk with you through anything and support you. And you know also that over time, that support group drops off. And it's not because they're intentionally breaking their promise to you. It's not because they don't care usually. It's just because other suffering has happened. Other needs have arisen with other friends and themselves. And over time, that support just dwindles. As the suffering wears on and on through these different seasons of your life. And here it is again. And it's another year and I'm still hurting in the same way. Just that duration of suffering just going on and on and on and on and on, seemingly endlessly in your life. You're like, I had some hope at year one. I had a little bit of hope at year two. Here's where I'm at now. You know, and I'm talking about not just health. It could be a relationship, you know, in my marriage, something with my kids, something with my job. It could be any number of things. My finances, they've been bad for as long as I can remember. The duration of suffering steals our hope. Secondly, you see here that the expense of suffering steals our hope. Verse 43 says that this woman, over these 12 years of time, she had literally, it says, spent all her living. So anything that she's making by whatever means she can make that money, she is turning around and she's hiring doctors. This is an interesting read about how in this time, you know, and you can read old Jewish writings of these different formulas and, you know, stew this kind of tea, throw these juniper things in there and brew this tea and drink the tea. And then your discharge of blood will stop. And I'm sure that she's tried all these things. She's gone to imaginative doctors and faith healers and different things. And she's spent all her money. And in our lives, some of you would say, literally, my finances have been exhausted by the very thing that I'm thinking of right now that's taken my hope. I've spent so much money chasing a solution, chasing a cure to this thing that I am literally impoverished trying to get out of this mess that I'm in. And it makes me feel hopeless because now not only do I have my initial problem, but now I don't have money for all the other stuff in my life. But, you know, suffering can exhaust all of your resources, not just money. Suffering can exhaust your energy physically. It can exhaust your emotional energy. We just feel like I have nothing left to give to people because not only has it gone on for a long time, but it has drained me. It has taken its toll on me. I have nothing left to spend on this. Thirdly, we see the incurableness of suffering. Verse 43 also says that not only has she spent all her living, but she could not be healed. And nothing sometimes is more hopeless to us than we have tried and tried and tried. And someone finally comes to our life and says, hey, but have you tried this? You know, and you could say, well, my suffering, my hopelessness is financial. And so you're like, I finally sat down with my church and I did Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. Yes. And it didn't work. Or health wise, you know, I've shared some, you know, transparently some struggles with my back pain. And you're like, finally, I have a doctor suggest something that no other doctor has ever suggested. We try that. It doesn't work. And you feel a sense of hopelessness. You're like, I guess this is just incurable. By the way, people often, you know, they come to me for counseling. And some of you have been counseled by me for various things. And one of my questions that I often ask people is, what have you already tried? And sometimes I get this blank stare like, I mean, what do you mean? What have I already tried? Like, I'm coming to you for solutions. But some of you have done that where you've gone to counseling for a relationship. You've gone to counseling for your career. You've gone to counseling for any number of things. And you're like, I tried what the counselor said. I tried it for a long time. It didn't work. I tried what the next therapist said. It didn't work. And the longer you try solutions and fixes and cures and they don't seem to work, the more hopeless you become. Because you're checking things off your list and you're becoming like this woman. You're thinking, I'm just not going to be healed. Again, physically, financially, relationally, emotionally, I'm just going to be a broken person forever. And it sets in. The fourth thing I see here that steals our hope is the stigma of suffering. Now, this may be missed as you just gloss over the text, but I don't want you to miss it, that this woman in her condition with this hemorrhage of blood coming out of her body for 12 years of her life, the book of Leviticus, the law of God over his covenant people, the Jews, would have said that this woman, because of her issue of blood, she was ceremonially unclean, which means she could not come into and be a part of the worshiping community. She couldn't go to the sanctuary of her local synagogue and worship with other followers of Yahweh. She was considered an outsider. She was considered an outcast. Everywhere she went, people knew this is the woman that has the thing that makes her unclean, that makes her other, that puts space between the people of God and her. So she carries a stigma. And again, we can easily generalize this because you do know, and many of you have even experienced this for yourself, you go through something that causes suffering, that causes pain physically, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. And you're thinking, this hurts enough as it is. This makes me hopeless enough as it is. But now to hear people chirping, now to hear people saying the things that they're saying and gossiping and assigning reasons why this has happened to me. And somebody may even drag in here this morning and your theology is still this theology that says, well, the reason the bad things happen to certain people is because they're bad people. And God is exposing that. And you're one of Job's friends. And you have this stigma added to the suffering that makes you feel even more hopeless because you feel the judgment, you feel the accusations, you feel the weight of other people's stares and their assumptions about you, and you carry some kind of stigma. And then the last thing I see here is the finality of suffering. And this is verse 49, where this little girl is going, gone. And they come to Jesus and they say, they're coming to the ruler of the synagogue in the presence of Jesus. And they're saying, don't trouble the master. Your daughter is dead. Right. And a lot of times we draw like hard lines where Jesus is just drawing a dotted line or something like that. And we're like, well, that's the end of the story. That's the end of the line. And some of you have actually literally experienced deaths in your family like this. And as I look out at different ones of you, I have prayed. I've been in hospitals with different ones of you and together in community praying for a miraculous deliverance. And that deliverance didn't come. And you know that finality, that moment it sinks in. This is done. Like, there's no reason to pray anymore for my dead mother, my dead child. They're gone. And how heartbreaking that is. How hopeless that makes us feel. Obviously, this too extends beyond just physical death. There could be things like, you know, there's this deadline for this job application and I'm praying and the deadline comes and goes and you realize someone else got the job that you wanted and there's a finality to your suffering. It was bad enough that you were waiting and waiting and waiting for God to come through for you or acceptance to a college or some of you like a master's or doctoral program. And you're waiting and waiting and waiting and it's suffering. You feel hopeless. But you're like, the decision hasn't been made yet. Maybe. Well, finality. There's no maybe. It's a done deal. Or some of you in a relationship, you know, you're praying for this relationship, and then the divorce is final. There's nothing you can do. And because of these five things that we see in the story, that we sense in our lives, the duration, the expense, the incurableness, the stigma, the finality, there are two things I want us to do in those five words. Number one, I want you to locate yourself in these stories. I don't want you to just say, well, those are weird stories, that bad things happen to those two people, that stinks to be them. I think with these five words, we can find something in our own lives where we're saying, yeah, I struggle with some despair, with some frustration, with some hopelessness because of some of that stuff that you just talked about. I find myself in the story, I identify with one of the or both of these characters. But secondly, the other thing I want those thieves of hope to do for all of us is to make us more aware of what's happening around us in community. Because there are people around you that are not going through one or two of these things. They're going right now through all five of these things. And we may not be the cure. Oftentimes, we are not the cure. We're not going to fix them. What we're going to do is love and embrace them and surround them with our prayers and surround them with our encouragement before, during, and after the suffering. That brings us to the source of hope. So we've located ourselves in the story. We said, okay, this is what's going on in my life. And if I'm honest, I pray about this a lot because it makes me feel despair. It makes me feel anger. It makes me feel hopeless. So what's the source of hope if we wanted hope? Well, simple answer is faith in Jesus. Notice in this story how faith is the central connection to healing, to hope. This woman has touched Jesus. And in verse 48, he says, daughter, your faith has made you well. And it was faith in Jesus that made her well. Verse 50, with the next story, hey, don't trouble the master anymore. Your child's dead. He says, do not fear, only believe. Jesus himself, faith, believe, trust. Do you really believe? Okay, so none of these other solutions, none of these other cures, none of these other programs and education, all these things that you've done have cured your problem. But do you have faith in me that I'm working for your good even when you can't see? And I want to say that both of these things, faith and in Jesus, both what we're doing to trust and the object of our trust, I think are both vitally important. Because it's not come to Jesus and work to prove to him that you deserve your deliverance from hopelessness. It's come to Jesus in trust that he will deliver you. But it's come to Jesus. And come only to Jesus. We don't typically as a culture say that the object of one's faith matters. You know, our postmodern culture says that what matters is faith. What matters is hope. As if faith and hope are just intrinsically valuable to live this way. But, I mean, obviously we can strip that down and show that that's kind of foolish. You know, we often drive up and go skiing and snowmobiling, do different things in the mountains. Okay, so I want you to picture two cars. And one of those cars has brand new Blizzak tires. Okay, like snow ice tires. And the other one's tires are completely bald. There's metal, there's mesh hanging out of them because there is no tread on them. And the driver of the Blizzak car says, I have really no confidence that I'm going to even be able to stay on the road. I'm terrified to drive in the snow. I don't like this. And he sets off on his journey. The guy in the bald tire car, he's like, dude, I got this. I drive this all the time. I drive in the snow. I drive on ice. I got this. So one guy has absolutely no faith, or this tiny kernel of faith in his Blizzaks. The other guy has all kinds of faith in his own ability to get himself there. Which of the two guys is he going to get there safely? What's the guy that had the right object, that had ice tires? And the guy that had all the confidence in the world, he can take his confidence right off the road and over the hillside with him. And that's what would happen. Obviously, it's important to have trust in hope in Jesus Christ, but it's important to have it in Jesus Christ. Because there's something quantitatively different about Jesus that can get us where we need to be in terms of our heart, in terms of our faith, in terms of our hope. Now, let me show you two characteristics here about the faith that these people have, and then two characteristics about Jesus, and bring these things back together again, faith in Jesus. First, I want you to note that the faith that these two people exhibit is an imperfect, immature faith. These people are not coming with Nicene Creed faith. Very God, we get this about Jesus. No, the first guy, the ruler of the synagogue, I mean, there's no indication earlier in the Gospels that he's come to Jesus for anything. Like, oh, I trust you as the Messiah. What's happened is, boom, something's happened in his life. And suddenly he's like, the law can't fix this. Doctors can't fix this. I need this guy who claims to be the Messiah. One pastor writes this, Jairus, that's his name, was like so many who have come to Christ. It was not his love for Christ that brought him. It was not what he hoped to do for Christ. It was his desperation and a glimmer of hope. Now get this. He says, despair is commonly the prelude to grace. I love that. Despair is often the prelude to grace. That God in his kindness has taken you to a very dark, very hopeless place and said, jump. I can't see you. It's okay, I see you. Despair is often the prelude to grace. That's where this first man is. This second man, you know, all the commentators note this about this woman. At best, we would have to say that her faith is immature because she's coming to Jesus the way someone would come superstitiously. Okay, there's no indication in the Gospels before this that everyone who simply came up to Jesus and touched something on him, pow, zap, they got healed. But she's thinking this way. Like, if I just touch him, I have this ray of hope that this will happen to me. Jesus was God and man. So my picture of him is not that he's sitting there walking through this crowd and this woman's coming up behind him and she's closing on him. And he's like, okay, 3, 2, 1, boom, there it is. It's not my picture of the story. It's just there's this hustle and bustle and all these people are bumping into him. And this one woman touches him with a different purpose than all these other people are touching him. It's a superstitious touch, but it's a touch of faith. Like, I believe against all hope that maybe he of all people can do something for me. And Jesus even turns and calls attention. Daughter, your faith has made you well. Your imperfect, your immature faith has made you well. I see here also that it's a gutsy faith. It's gutsy for both of these people. I don't know if you realize that, as you just read the story on a superficial level, but the guy, he is the ruler of the synagogue. What does it cost him to come to Jesus and say, Master, you've got to come to my house. You can make my daughter well. Do you realize it could cost this man everything? It could cost him his reputation. It could cost him his position. Because, you know, the Jews weren't terribly fond of Jesus. They didn't, many of them, think that he was the Messiah. The official religious establishment certainly didn't think he was the Messiah. They were against him. But this guy's saying, I'm willing to lose all of that for my chance at my daughter's healing in this man. The woman exhibits a similar gutsiness where she's going through this crowd, and I picture her covered, whether with a shawl or pulling like a hood up over her, because, again, she would not be allowed to be seen in this mob, in this crowd. If someone saw her and recognized her, they would call her out as like, hey, you can't be here, because for her to touch someone else made them ceremonially unclean. You imagine how many people she bumped into going through the crowd to get to Jesus. But she's willing to cover up and just push her way through to make her way to Jesus. She's courageous. She's like, okay, it's imperfect, it's immature, but I got to get to Jesus. And I love in both of these stories, the reality is some people will just never even try to get to Jesus until this thought occurs to them. What have I got to lose? You know, and maybe you've been walking with God for 10, 20, 40 years, and you're like, what have I got to lose? That's not faith. Well, it's fledgling faith. Despair is often the prelude to grace, right? And they're coming saying, what have I got to lose? I could lose my reputation. I could be even further outcast than I already am. But I've tried everything else and nothing will work. What do I have to lose? I've got to touch Jesus. Now, let me show you two reasons why touching Jesus makes sense. Number one, in this story, you see that he has the power that you need. He has the power you need. I mean, he's literally stopping here and he says, whoa, hold on a second. Who touched me? Peter's like, oh, man, here we go again. And Master, everyone's touching you. What do you mean someone touched me? He's like, well, I felt power. That's inherent power. Go out of me. Like, he felt something. And this woman was immediately healed, even with her broken, immature faith. She's immediately healed, completely healed. And she knows it in her body. She knows. Something just happened. Like all the medicines, all the potions that doctors have tried, I never felt that feeling. I know I've been healed. And then, my goodness, I mean, verses 54 and 55, he goes into a dead girl. And he can look at death as if, well, she's not really dead. I mean, she is, but she's sleeping. Because I can just wake her up. Watch this. And he has the power to bring her back from death to life. Jesus has the power that you need. Again, whether it's a health thing, a financial thing, a relational thing, an emotional thing, whether it's something broader in our culture, I'm not telling you what God will do specifically in your instance. I'm saying one of the reasons we come to Jesus in faith is because he has all the power we need to do exactly what he wants to do in our lives. But we also come to Jesus because not only is the power there, but the compassion is there. Okay, we got a lot of medical people in here. You work over at the hospitals, nurses, doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, all that. How many of you think this is good triage? You're like, okay, you got a girl on her deathbed, like desperately in need of the Savior to get there. You've got this other woman, and she's got a real need. And I'm not diminishing the fact she has a real need, but she's had it for 12 years. And it's not really that different today than it was yesterday, the day before, or the past thousands of days. And the ER doctor, Jesus, is sitting there saying, okay, I'm going to fix the little girl before she dies. Wait, hold on a second. And at the very least, you think Jesus could have grabbed this woman and said, you know what, I got to head over here. You come with me and let's talk on the way. But he stops intentionally. That's why I call this message Hope Interrupted. Because this guy has hope. Jesus, if he gets here in time, he can help my daughter. Well, that's interrupted by someone else's hope, and Jesus stops, and now my hope is dead, but not really, because it's Jesus. And he has the power to call someone back, even from death to life. But you would say, this is really bad triage. This is really inefficient. But I think the story boils down to the compassion of Jesus for both of these people. He stops, and he lets her be a person, not just a touch, but a human being with a face and a name. And he looks at her. And he talks to her. By the way, you notice how one of these things was private and Jesus made it public. That's the woman. The other was public and Jesus made it private. Isn't that interesting? And I think both of those happened because of Jesus' compassion. The private thing, this woman comes. No one knows who I am. I'm sneaking up to Jesus. I'm touched. Whoa, I'm healed. I'm sure she's like, praise God, and worshiping in her heart. But she's sneaking away, right? Why? Because she can't be seen. She's the outcast. She's the outsider. She's the unclean. She shouldn't be there. Why does Jesus stop and say, who touched me? And when she realized she's discovered, she's like, well, it was me. This is how far Jesus' compassion extends to this woman. Do you know what Jesus is doing by taking something very private and making it public? He's showing everyone else. This is the woman that you've isolated for 12 years. This is the woman that's been the outcast, the unclean, the unacceptable, the pariah. Guess what? I'm saying in the presence of all of you, she's clean. Welcome her. She is now part of your worshiping community because of my work in her body. You accept her as I've accepted her. He's making something private, public, to show everyone she's cleansed, she's accepted, welcome her. The other, he takes something very public, this master of the synagogue, this ruler, this very popular person in Capernaum. Everyone knows who this guy. Oh, no, his daughter's dead. And you say, who are all these mourners? Well, they hire mourners in Jewish culture. So they got this band playing. Everyone's crying. They're paid to do this. There are lots of people that are genuinely sad. And he says, send them all out. I just need your parents. And three, kind of my inner circle of disciples. Why? So that when this girl wakes up from death, she doesn't freak out. He's already thinking, this girl doesn't need to sit up from being dead and be surrounded by a throng of people she doesn't know, like clapping, shouting, screaming, doing whatever they're going to do. She needs her parents to say, you know what, here's a meal. And that's the compassion of Jesus, to take her public need and make it private. So we think about these points here, and again, we apply them to ourselves. You know, even if we have imperfect faith, come to Jesus. Come boldly. Even if you're at the point this morning where you're thinking, I don't know that I believe everything you're saying this morning, but what do I have to lose? Come. You're invited to come, because he has the power and the compassion that you need for your thing. Now, these last two points are fairly quick, but I want to give them to you because it's not just that Jesus is the source of hope. I want to show you what it cost Jesus to do what he did in this story. So I call this the cost of hope. The first thing is that Jesus identified with these two characters, and he identifies with you in your hopelessness. Now, here's what I mean. You'll see that with this woman, the word touched is repeated four times. And Luke is taking pains in his story to say touched, 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 touched. He touched her. Why is that important? Well, it's important because in any culture, virtually a touch, a physical touch, not just looking at someone, but touching, is a sign of acceptance, is a sign of identifying with someone. But there's something more than that, because when Jesus touches her, what does the law say? She's unclean, he's clean. What happens? The clean becomes unclean, according to the law. And Jesus is saying in very clear terms, once everybody realizes what Jesus did, I'm sure they went back to their homes and talked about it. Wait, the rabbi's unclean now because he let this woman touch her. He identified with her in her uncleanness. And isn't that exactly what Jesus came to earth to do? That's not all he came to do, but he did come to identify with us in our brokenness, in our sin, in our uncleanness, saying, if it costs me my reputation to identify with you, to touch you, so you know that I love you, so that you know that I have a cure for you, I will identify with you, I will touch you. He does the same thing in the second story. It says, again, it doesn't use the word touch, but it says, like, he sits there on the bed, or he leans over this child, and it says, taking her by the hand. Again, this is not what a rabbi does in this culture. She's dead. For him to touch a dead body makes him unclean. But in both of these stories, you see the touch. In both of these stories, you see Jesus willingly identifying with something that's unclean and filthy and an outcast and even dead. But you know, Jesus does more than identifying with you. Jesus exchanges himself for your hopelessness. Now, what do you mean? We were watching this movie this weekend, this Last of the Mohicans. Some of you have probably seen it, with Daniel Day-Lewis. You know, it's this whole, like, French and Indian War. And you're like, wait, which side are all these different Indians on? The Mohicans, and you got the Hurons and the Iroquois, and all these different Indians doing all these different things. You got the French and the British, and they're fighting over land in the American colonies, and the American colonists trying to decide which side they're on. We got this scene at the end where they're standing before, I think it's the Council of the Huron, and the great Poobah, whatever his name is, like, he's sitting there and he's ruling on this whole thing. And you've got British here and French, and you got colonialists, and you've got these two daughters of the commander of the British army. And he basically says, okay, to make everyone happy, here's what's going to happen. Like, you get to marry you and go free. You take your stuff and go home. You die in the fire. And the someone that's going to die in the fire is Korah, that the main character is in love with her. So he speaks in French to this Indian. He says, me for her. Take me for her. I think the reason that's powerful is because intuitively, deep down, we understand that love always involves an exchange. And that's the most powerful exchange that someone could make, is to say, I love this person so much, instead of them dying, I would die in their place. Well, do you know, looking at these stories, that Luke's going to tell there's a day coming where, you know how it is that Jesus can stop the flow of a woman's blood? It's because there's a day coming when the flow of his blood will not be stopped. He's going to hang on a cross, and no one comes and rescues him. No one comes and stops his flow of blood. He bleeds out. The reason that this woman who's unclean, who's an outcast, the reason she can become clean and be welcomed in, the reason that her shame is taken away is ultimately because Jesus will go to the cross, stripped naked, with our sin placed on him. He becomes uncleanness. He becomes sin for us. He becomes shame for us so that we can walk away unashamed. And this little girl, he died. He died. So that he could go into death and hell and come back and have the power over it. There's this exchange. So let's remember that as we're sitting here wringing our hands and our hearts and we're heartbroken and we're hurting and we're sometimes angry and frustrated at God, if we're honest. Let's remember this, that the Jesus we come to is a Jesus who has identified with us in our brokenness, in our suffering, in our hopelessness, and not only identified with us to say, I love you, I accept you, but he said, I'll go down, I'll take the worst thing so that you can be free. See, we're only ultimately hopeless, or hopeless in an ultimate sense, if we are separated from God. Every other sense of hopelessness that we have, financial, physical, cancer, whatever, we could die in hope in Jesus and be with him and realize, oh man, all my sense of hopelessness, all my sense of despair, it was real for the present time, but it's been superseded by an eternal hope in Jesus. You know, the only hopelessness that can ultimately sink you is if you be separated from God. And do you know Jesus even exchanged himself for that? That as he's hanging on the cross, he was separated from God the Father so that we never have to be, so that we never have to be hopeless. In our suffering, in our pain, we can look to the one who took our uncleanness, who took our shame, who took our pain, who took our abandonment, who took our death, so that we can have all of the opposite in him. This is the Christian gospel. This is what the Bible teaches. So finally, what do we do with this message then? I call this the outcome of hope. Two simple and parallel points. Number one, notice the outcome of hope is you get what you need. What do you need? We prayed this the other night over the community center, our first Friday. We just say to God what you need. I need this. Someone else, well, I need this. I need this. And you look at this story and in both stories, what do these people need? They needed a healing. But, you know, Jesus uses a word for healing in both of these stories that means not only physical healing, it's actually the word for salvation. These people didn't just get their bodies fixed. They got saved. They got rescued. That's what they ultimately needed. They got cleansing. They got acceptance. He tells this woman, go into peace. And you can see how that happens as well, that she is not at peace for these 12 years. She's not at peace with her body physically. She is not at peace emotionally, she's not at peace relationally. She can't come and worship God. There's all this turmoil, all this pain in her life. She's not at peace. And with just a touch, Jesus can say, go into peace, go into physical peace, go into emotional peace, go into ceremonial peace, go into spiritual peace with God. Love, life. You know, what do you need? Go to Jesus in prayer and, you know, just confess. These are the things that I need. I'm not promising you some kind of prosperity gospel. You just pray a prayer. You pray a certain prayer with enough faith or pray it enough times. And voila, there it is. There's everything I feel like I need. But in the end, I'm talking about in the grand picture that God is orchestrating with our lives. If we are in him, we get everything we need. And Jesus gets what he deserves. Because you see that the outcome of these stories is awe. And that's what Jesus deserves. Is our awe directed at him, saying, my mind is blown, my heart is blown. I'm torn apart by what Jesus does, but then I'm put back together and I'm healed. And I'm amazed, I'm astonished at the love of Christ, at the power of Christ, at this exchange that Christ works where it's his cost, he's bearing it, so someone else gets to go free from their thing. And I want you to understand this. You know, I say, like, you get what you need. God gets what he deserves. And it's important to see those two things together. Because there's even Christian but unchristian, like in church but unchristian teaching that somehow communicates to people, like the next generation, hey, God's glory and your joy are found in two different places. And if you're ever going to be satisfied, if you're ever going to be happy, if you're ever going to get what you want and what you need, you're going to have to do things your own way. It's not true. You know, by immersing yourself in the glory of God, saying, I want my life to be for the glory of Jesus. You know, your joy and His glory are not found in two different places. They're found in the same place. They're found in the same resolution. You come with your brokenness. You come with your immature faith. And this is where I want to end this, that I don't want anyone here to wait until you've turned your desperation around. Like, man, I am so messy. I'm not going to talk about this in church. I'm not going to admit this, even to God, not even in my prayers. Well, guess what? He already sees it. So just go ahead and say, like, okay, I'll come. My faith is immature. There are things I don't get about you, or I don't even know if I believe everything about you that the Bible says. And we're waiting until we figure out all the nuances of faith. And then we're like, okay, then I'll come when my life is clean and put back together. That's foolish, because Jesus is the only one who can do that healing. He's the only one who can bring that hope. And out of that hope flows everything else. This one writer says, beginning faith is often uninformed and mixed with errors and misconceptions about, for example, Christ's person, the Trinity, the atonement, grace works, or scriptures. But foggy understandings are often the true beginning of an authentic, informed trust in God. Like, aren't you grateful as you look at these stories that these people came with a foggy, uninformed faith in Jesus? Because He did something in each of their lives that clarified not only His power to save, but the nature of that salvation. Not only am I able to save you, but I'm going to do it at great cost to myself. I'm going to take your place. And both of these characters walked away with a much deeper, much richer faith in Christ because they just came. So, friends, come as you are in faith. Wherever you're at in your spiritual walk, come in faith. And reach out, you know, like the woman, I'm kind of like graphically picturing this, but reach out. And as you do that in faith, what I think many of you will come to realize is that He's been reaching out to you all along.